Hi everyone, welcome to our latest Artemis Live podcast episode. First off, my apologies, it's been a few weeks since the last, but we're in the middle of a marathon of 9 virtual webcasts for our new Prospectus 2021 conference right now, and so things have been very busy. Please visit www.artemis.bm and have a look under our events section where you can watch all sessions from Prospectus 2021 live as well as on demand. So in this latest podcast episode, I'm bringing you a discussion from an event we held back in July where I was lucky enough to get 3 very experienced end investors in ILS together to discuss the market and actually what end investors really want. Now, among this group are probably close to $8 billion worth of assets deployed into the ILS capital space, with Evelyn Takensomers from PGGM in the Netherlands, Bernard van der Stichel from Healthcare of Ontario Pension Plan in Canada, and Craig Dandurand from the Future Fund of Australia. Getting these 3 together to speak about their experiences in allocating to insurance and securities of recent years and also what they really want from the asset class was a privilege. It's rare to get such experienced ILS investors all together, and the insights they shared should prove fascinating to anyone allocating to insurance assets or considering it. At a time like this, when interest in ILS and catastrophe bonds is resurging, it seems these investors share are some of the larger allocators in the space already and so have a lot of good information to share. They highlight the importance of ILS fund managers educating their investors and being as transparent as possible when it comes to reporting. They also discuss how loss creep has been perhaps the most challenging factor to come to terms with of recent years, even more so than the original catastrophe loss event impacts. As well as the fact ILS is still an asset class that is maturing and how these investors are seeing positive changes now as investment managers adjust to the realities they've faced of late. Finally, they also discuss the need for proactive relationships, underlining the importance that ILS fund managers communicate regularly and openly with them to help end investors understand any challenges they may face and also to work together in partnership on making better investment strategies. So with that, it's over to this discussion from July, which I hope you enjoy. We'll be back with more regular podcast sessions soon, and there's a lot to talk about right now with the end of year renewals fast approaching, as well as an acceleration in the cat bond market to discuss and other factors such as ESG. So please stay tuned to www.artemis.bm for all of our ILS market news, analysis, data and insights. Hi everyone, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining us today for our next session of the ILS Asia 2020 conference. Today we're going to be hearing from 3 very experienced pension fund investors who all allocate to ILS strategies and have a great experience of looking at the range of products available to them and making decisions based on their assessment of managers and strategies. Delighted to have Evelyn Takensomers, Senior Director and Lead Portfolio Manager of the Insurance Portfolio at the Netherlands-based pension investor PGGM. We also have Bernard van der Stichel, who's Portfolio Manager for ILS in the Fixed Income and Derivatives Unit of the Healthcare of Ontario Pension Plan. And we have Craig Dandurand, who's Head of Debt at the Future Fund of Australia. So these 3 people are extremely experienced. They're very well known, obviously, in the sector, as people do tend to keep track of the investors in the space. That's where the capital comes from. And obviously, the industry is very keen to keep the investor base happy. So hopefully there's something for everybody to learn today from this session. It's not really often that we get 3 end investors all together in one place to discuss the market and why it appeals to them as an asset class. So hopefully we'll hear more about what they would really like to see from the range of products on offer and how the development of the market is expected to go from the investor base point of view. So please enjoy this discussion and don't forget to post questions in the Q&A box in front of you. You can ask us anything you like. The investors will answer the questions towards the end of the session. So please don't be shy to ask for insights into anything specific that you'd like to know more about. So to begin, I thought it'd be useful for those watching that we'll run through each of our panelists and ask them to just discuss briefly their respective approaches to investing in ILS, their organisation, and sort of their personal viewpoint on the asset class. So let's begin with Evelyn.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Steve, for having me on this panel. Our client, PwC, invests in insurance-linked investments since 2006. They have a clear focus on catastrophe reinsurance. The insurance-linked investment portfolio is externally managed, which means that we allocate to ILS managers and to reinsurance companies through quota shares. Our mandate has a clear return and risk objective. Risk is managed through multiple guidelines, such as expected loss, PML, and through some points on the AAP curve. Regarding my personal opinion, I do believe that an ILS portfolio could be broader than cat only. Also, I see some of our peers being very successful in having a bifurcated strategy, allocating to ILS fund managers on the one hand, and transacting directly with counterparties on an excess of loss basis on the other hand. So apparently, it's if you execute it well, it goes hand in hand. I look forward to kind of a better returning environment that we're experiencing right now.
Absolutely, don't we all? So Bernard.
Yeah, good morning, Steve, and everyone else watching. And again, thank you for having me with you today. So the healthcare Voluntary Pension Plan has entered the market fairly recently, at least in the ILS space. And it views the asset class really as a low correlation asset class that will add value to the overall investment mix at the pension fund. The strategy is really still being developed, but essentially it will follow what a lot of other end investors, the strategy a lot of other investors have followed, and that is to build a portfolio of diversified across ILS related risks and looking at deals on a return per unit of risk basis, essentially. Personally, I've been in the market since 2005, and I've seen sort of the dynamics of the market change over time, but essentially the strategy has never really deviated very much. Essentially, it's about capturing well understood and well quantified risks and being paid accordingly for them.
Great, thank you, Bernard. And then Craig.
Thanks, Steve, and good evening from Melbourne. I am the head of debt for the Future Fund, which is Australia's sovereign wealth fund, which the main fund is about $160 billion Australian, give or take a few billion here or there, depending upon market volatility. In that role, part of my remit is the insurance-linked securities portfolio, which is, give or take, call it 1% of the total asset base. It is much as Evelyn and Bernard would have mentioned in their comments, it is designed to be expressly diversifying to most of everything else we have. It is a property catastrophe oriented portfolio. We have an eye toward other perils as well, but property cat is the core of what we do. Since 2015. I think like my colleagues here, I think we're all looking forward to at least better top line revenue in this space. Hopefully that's borne out the bottom line as we go through what has been an otherwise chaotic 2020. Hopefully we'll have a quiet wind season at least.
Thank you, Craig. So yes, I probably should have mentioned for the audience's benefit that we're spanning quite a few time zones here today, all the way from Toronto to Melbourne in Australia. So thank you all for joining at your respective mornings and evenings. And then for Evelyn, at least it's the middle of the day, but I'm probably interrupting your lunch. So a lot has happened in the last few years since obviously the hurricanes of 2017 were a real sort of, or looking back, maybe seen as a bit of a turning point, perhaps, in the way the ILS market has dealt with, well, in terms of dealing with losses, it's probably the first major experience for a lot of people, but also in the way people have looked at underlying risks and perhaps contract language and various other issues. And it's probably the first time for many people that trapped collateral actually became a real thing. So I'd be interested to hear from you that a lot's changed since then. But what has this experience of dealing with losses, creep, uncertainty, and trapped collateral taught you? And has that changed your view on and strategy going forwards? Let's begin with Craig.
Yeah, I'm probably still the relative newbie in this virtual room here, so I'm happy to take the lead. When I started in the space, looking at it back in 2014, I think I quickly came across a lot of parallels, or sort of inverted parallels, I guess you could call it, with debt, in the sense that when you lend money, you're fighting to get it back. When you insure something, you're fighting to hang on to the capital, and only pay it out when it's appropriate to do so. And I think that the disappointments for us have been mostly with just simply the nature of the loss experience itself, rather than manager behavior per se. But I think many of the issues that you alluded to, Steve, like loss creep, like just the nature of the losses, the issue about collateral being trapped, on one level, don't feel unfamiliar if you're somebody that's used to lending, because the trapped collateral equivalent in the lending universe is that you take longer to get a recovery from a loan that's gone wrong. So it's more a matter, I think, of going into it, were we prepared for those eventualities? And I think anytime you go into an asset class that has an unclear potential outcome, you have to be prepared for that sort of volatility of realization of gains or losses, much less the volatility of the actual cash flows themselves. The timing comes into play. And so I think the surprises were more in terms of it's the range of outcomes, the different range of events, the extent to which, at least during the first series of losses, the relative alacrity with which capital was redeployed, or made available to redeploy, that was a bit dispiriting, I guess you could say. And so, in a sense, it feels like we could be at the start of a bit of relief here, in the sense that on my other day job, on the credit side, you see credit spreads having tightened very, very quickly after the COVID-related events back in February, March, and April. Here you haven't quite seen that snapback this time around. And so it's a realization and a reminder that markets move at their own cadence as well. But we're still learning, and I'm sure we'll be learning long into the future.
Thank you, Craig. Yeah, it's an important point that even the ILS market as a whole is only, close to 25 years old, really. So it's been a learning experience for everyone. Evelyn, how has the experience of the last 3 years sort of equipped you going forwards?
Well, this period was clearly a challenge for the whole market. I think dealing with losses itself is not a big problem. We spent quite some time educating our clients, so the losses itself did not raise many questions. Having 3 years in a row with above average catastrophe losses did raise questions. We received questions regarding climate change, and I hope to encourage the industry to spend more time understanding and explaining this topic. That would be of great help. Loss creep, that actually did bother us quite a lot. When loss reserves are adjusted, end up multiple times higher than anticipated, it does raise questions. On our side, does our manager fully understand what kind of risk they have onboarded? Are they knowledgeable on loss reserving? And how do they ultimately reserve? Do they take a conservative stand, or do they follow ceded notification only? So we don't mind reporting to our client that we lost capital, but going back and back again doesn't look great on anyone. Neither on us. So it raises questions whether we are in control of what we do and whether we misjudge the manager's investment process. Or at least the reserving part, which is quite relevant. So I would say Lost Creep was definitely the kind of the worst experience out of everything that happened in the last couple of years. When it comes to trapped collateral, I think less so an issue on our side. We were in the luxurious position to have experienced trapped collateral before that in a relatively quiet season. And because of this, most of our contracts roll forward very efficiently into the next risk period. So again, trapped collateral, not one of our main issues.
Great. Thank you, Evelyn. Bernard, what's your view on I know you weren't at your current fund during the 2017 hurricanes, but obviously you've been watching that develop closely.
Sure. And as a matter of fact, in 2017, 2018, I was actually with a fund manager. So I sort of got a peek behind the curtains and kind of saw how things worked. I would agree with everything that's been said so far. I would add that, the ILS market, again, is a relatively new market with a short history, and we're dealing with rare events. And so sequences of years like 2017 and 18, that sequence of events was really new for many people in the industry, not just investors, but fund managers included. It was interesting to observe how incumbent markets, dealt with loss estimates, and then communicated that to investors. And so I think everybody, learned something out of those couple of years. I expect we will speak about it later, but it really, I think it speaks to sort of the lack of transparency in a way, in terms of what investors are typically being shown across the spectrum of ILS products and opportunities versus how the risk is actually sourced and packaged and managed before it gets to investors. And it is through these events that you really, that folks will really dig deeper and try to understand how losses are processed, and over time, get more sophisticated in their thinking and understanding of the market and what effectively we are funding in a way. So I think, a lot of lessons were learned.
Great, thank you. Yeah, so certainly a lot of lessons learned, a lot more lessons for people to learn currently in the market environment, as we're in a firming environment that seems like it could be a little more sustainable than we've seen for quite a while, but has yet to be proven out how sustainable. But all of these learnings obviously factor into your day jobs of selecting strategies and managers and reinsurers and partners in general. So I'm interested to know, what do you look for in your partner selection, and what's absolutely key to you if you're going to develop a relationship with somebody in this marketplace? Let's begin with Evelyn, given you probably have the widest range of partnerships of the group so far.
I think we have 10 partners across ILS managers and reinsurance companies, and we manage 12 different kind of products, even more today across these partners. So we look at three key elements that need to come together before we engage into a relationship. The first element is the partner itself. Each of our partners is selected because of their solid underwriting, modeling capabilities, market visibility, and also thorough claims handling expertise. We spend a lot of time going through their books of business, trying to understand whether we also are able to understand ourselves what kind of risk are part of that. So is it occurrence or aggregate exposed, and also try to understand how these guys model such transactions. Second element is efficient structure. Clearly, we look at cost, operational leverage, efficient rollover mechanism, and a clear exit strategy. So that's second element. And thirdly, we strive for an optimal alignment of interest. For our reinsurance partners, for example, we need to see contract by contract retention. And if we are allocating to an aligned manager, so part of a manager, part of a larger reinsurance organization, we will not accept, for example, risk of the parent company because we don't want to be anti-selected and we do care a lot of alignment. In general, we value innovation, responsiveness, and transparency. Exactly what Bernard already mentioned. Transparency makes the big difference between understanding it and not understanding what we invest in.
Great, thank you, Evelyn. And Craig, from your point of view, obviously you manage or look after within your role assets across a much broader spectrum than just ILS as a whole. But when you're looking at the ILS managers who you want to partner with and you're surveying the asset class for what's available, what's really important to you?
It's a bit hard to follow Evelyn when she runs down a list like that and you know that she and her team spend all day at the depth that they do. It's quite remarkable. So there's nothing per se that I would add to what Evelyn said as far as the different mechanics of a manager that we seek to work with. I think a couple of things that I might be a bit more colloquial in my phrasing is that I think there's an element. Look, underwriting is paramount to all of this, right? The best structuring can't fix good underwriting, and an element of this that has come to the fore, which Evelyn alluded to, is the extent to which claims management, loss management, if you will, the extent to which a manager is able to limit that. That does become that's as much a part of the overall underwriting process in insurance as it is in lending. If I lend into a bad situation but find a way to restructure it effectively, that's generating alpha, if you will, by mitigating losses. The same is true here in insurance. So a lot of the things that we look for in a debt manager are the same things we look for in an insurance manager. One of the most important elements of that, though, and again to use the colloquialism here, is that we look for battle scars. We look for managers that have learned lessons ideally on somebody else's dime, hopefully 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so they have seen enough evolution in the market and enough times when things repeat or when things rhyme to go, all right, this is a situation that I want to operate within, or a situation that I need to get out of. And so a combination ultimately of diligence, humility, battle scars, and opportunism ends up being what we're looking for. Again, to use the colloquial components of the list that Evelyn alluded to, that alignment is absolutely critical though. Having a team that is aligned, having a governance structure that is aligned with the end investor's goals, and what we think we're paying for is paramount. And that's a tricky one for a manager to get across, especially when they're part of a larger insurance relationship, because then you are explicitly dealing with two masters, right? You're dealing with the shareholders and you're dealing with your LPs. It's not easy. And the managers that do a good job of balancing that and really figuring out where the balance needs to be struck and where the lines need to be drawn tend to be much better shape when things go bad.
Great, thank you, Craig. So Bernard, you've seen both sides of this from the ILS manager point of view and now from the end investor point of view. Have you got anything to add? Is there anything you've learned from your time on the other side that has informed your manager selection?
Oh, probably, but I would echo what's been said so far, and I would also add to that. I mean, you know, when I speak to a fund manager or a reinsurance counterparty, it's also about finding common ground in our thinking about risk and risk taking, and getting paid for it. And I think, you know, it's through a lot of discussions and conversations that you really get to get a feel for how the team thinks about risk, underwriting, and so on. And I think that's critical. A lot of fund managers have teams that come from the underwriting world. That is their background. And so they may have thought about portfolio management differently than someone coming in from the capital markets. And I think it's important for both sides to understand those backgrounds and find common ground in terms of how you look at opportunities and how you build a book. Coming in, having seen many fund proposals and fund pitch books in the time that I've been in the ILS market, you know, there's always an element of going beyond the slides and really digging deeper into the background, and that goes across all aspects of fund management, from, you know, risk modeling to underwriting process to claims management, and track record, obviously, as Craig mentioned, that is really key. And a fund that has enough seniority to have gone through the ups and downs of the market is critical. But again, you really need to get a very good feel for how the team approaches every aspect of fund management, and look for alignment of interest along the way, because obviously that is really significant. And I think it is sometimes challenging to find that common ground. And I would encourage all investors in ILS looking at ILS to really spend time understanding what I would call the traditional underwriting process, how underwriters work, their relationships to brokers, and how risk is sourced, because that's the beginning of sort of the risk food chain, if you will. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah. No, it's a good point that there's more to it than just following a track record of returns in terms of the expertise that's required to run a profitable ILS management operation, but then also to understand how the reinsurance market works in general and how the full process works from origination right through to your investments into the risk. Just as a slight aside, Evelyn, perhaps given your range of partners and the number of strategies you deploy to, do you think that since the pandemic, obviously due diligence is going to be different? Have you thought about this, and how do you expect to overcome this if travel is less simple, or people are less keen to see travelers arriving?
Yeah, well, partially we solve for it with the technology, such as these conferences. So, and I do believe that we actually all we gain experience with that as well. So, I think so far so good. I would also say it's easier with existing relationships. So, if you have visited company multiple times, then it's easier to discuss new products, new initiatives, to spend some time picking up the phone, discussing maybe some parts that you not fully understand. So I would say it's more challenging for a new relationship than for existing, and hopefully the situation will be solved within half a year, so that we can again all meet physically as well and continue to perform due diligence as we always do. It's very difficult to look into someone's systems on a remote basis. You rather go into the company itself and look people in the eye than do it this way.
Yeah, and it's much easier to do that when you've already met somebody in a work environment or a social environment or whatever it might be, at a conference, to then dive deeper into their strategy is usually an easier conversation rather than having to cold call people and get to know them over a Zoom call.
Correct. Bernard, at least for me, that's...
Oops. Yeah. Bernard, sorry, you're looking to partner directly with managers, but also I believe you look to transact directly with counterparties as well as at Hoop. How does that fit into your workflow? And which do you feel most comfortable with? Is it manager allocation or as direct as possible?
I think the challenges with both approaches are different. I think, you know, my experience in the ILS market has always combined sort of direct trading and investing, as well as investing through ILS fund managers and dealing with more directly with or through reinsurance counterparties. And, you know, I personally think that this mix, this combination is adds a lot of value, because at the end of the day, an investor, I don't think can really compete with traditional reinsurance players or even ILS managers whose sole focus is reinsurance and ILS. There are so many sort of areas of expertise that you need to master to be able to manage the risk, that you have to be careful to limit your direct investments or participation where, you know, you are comfortable dealing with the process and you are sure that you are not being disadvantaged in any way. And so, for example, trading cat bonds is one thing. Doing collateralized reinsurance will introduce other challenges, and you really have to make sure that you have the capabilities to go that far. So when I think of fund managers versus investing or trading directly, it's a question of the benefits that each aspect brings. I think trading directly in the cat bond market has been very beneficial for myself in terms of understanding the risk, understanding the analysis process, and understanding sort of market dynamics. But at the end of the day, it only gives you experience in one sort of slice of the market that has its own limitations. And so you really need to partner with certain fund managers or other counterparties who have much greater capabilities in house and have accumulated a lot more experience than you have, and are closer to the market on a daily basis. So it's really being, you know, it's about balancing both of these aspects.
Great, thank you, Bernard. So I think let's move forwards onto the issue of data and transparency, which has already been mentioned a couple of times. It's often cited as an issue across the sort of insurance and reinsurance chain, with less transparency for players at different levels in the marketplace. It's partly naturally due to the type of contracts they're underwriting, but also partly because submissions appear to contain less data as the transaction gets to secondary and tertiary covered, I suppose. But viewers and investors, how do you feel about the way this is being managed in the marketplace, and what kind of changes would you like to see? And are you seeing evidence of changes, or do you feel this is just something that the market has not yet begun to really try and resolve? Let's begin with Craig.
You know, I'm going to be careful how I respond to that, because I think we've got two colleagues here on the stage, if you will, that are going to be in this all day, every day, and be in it on a line by line basis, with a bit more depth than my team's able to accomplish. I think, however, we know that, right? We also know that we don't have the bandwidth to do that, and so there's a degree of reliance on our managers and on the industry as a whole to be as transparent as possible and as proactive as possible. I think this is where probably the industry has gotten a bit cranky, and understandably so, about loss creep and about valuations. Evelyn alluded to the fact before that you've got, you know, some folks that won't do anything with their marks until after they get something resembling a border row coming in. And others are at least trying to be a bit more proactive in their valuation frameworks. I think the key in all of this is to be upfront, proactive, and consistent, while acknowledging that circumstances change. So I'd leave it to the other two to talk about with a bit more degree of granularity on the individual lines. But I think for us, what's been increasingly prominent for us is digging through the overlap between individual events and the impact on the portfolio and sort of the trend over time. We have the benefit, if you want to call it that now, of having 5 years of live data in our own portfolios and be able to build what looks a bit more like a loss triangle and to sort of compare that at least intellectually with what you might see from a non-ILS insurer, if you will. I think the trend is good, but I think that, and I'm sure many managers would agree, that the more they provide, the more you ask. But that's the nature of a good relationship, I think.
Thanks, Craig. Yeah, and I guess from the manager's point of view as well, they are reliant on the data and transparency flowing up from the bottom of the market. Evelyn, with such a wide range of partners and strategies, I guess you probably notice differences as well between different areas of the market, different types of strategies, different partnerships. What's your views on data and transparency and their importance?
Well, I think, yes, it is important, both transparency as well as reporting on that. You're right, we see a lot of different partners with different backgrounds as well. So I would say that some companies are listed, therefore more difficult to share certain levels of information compared maybe to a standalone ILS manager. Overall, I do believe that data quality has improved over the years. For the majority of our investments, we have by now full, I would say, line-by-line transparency, which does not all... It typically gives us information about exposure, so kind of peril type exposure, expected loss. So it gives a clear indication. In addition to that, all our partners deliver aggregate model data twice per year. This we really require because there's so many partners in our portfolio at this moment in time. For us, in order to understand our overall risk profile, we need to aggregate that data. So that's definitely a must-have.
Thank you. And Bernard, any further thoughts?
I would echo what Evelyn just said. I think, you know, first of all, the availability of data and transparency has improved a lot since, you know, the 2005 time period when I first got involved in ILS. I think we should always strive to get more transparency. There is still definitely a lot of pushback when you ask for, you know, sort of line by line details about programs, et cetera. But I think it's becoming increasingly necessary because risk model output in and of itself has its own limitations. And so the more you know about an underlying book, the more you can sort of, the more insight you have into the data you then receive and analyze. So, you know, at my end, I'm going to be striving to get more transparency. But, you know, at the same time, I've seen the ebbs and flows in transparency, which parallel the state of the market. And so when capital is scarce, solid transparency becomes much easier to obtain. And likewise, when capital is plentiful, it kind of can go to the wayside. So you have to keep pushing to maintain the same level of transparency, I think. You know, as you know, at Hoop we've licensed a risk catastrophe platform, and I've always licensed CAT models and spent a great deal of time understanding the modeling methodologies, the limitations, and so on. And I think that's an important part of the process to be able to really get your hands dirty with that data, understand what it is, and understand data quality. And that leads to a lot more questions and eventually much more in-depth discussions about the underwriting process with the manager that then, you know, lead to just overall better results over the long term.
Great, thank you. And I guess hand in hand with sort of data and transparency, there's also the question of underwriting practices. And this, I suppose, has been highlighted by COVID-19 again, which has also highlighted perhaps timing differences in how some people have addressed potential losses versus when, which is obviously very challenging with COVID-19 because loss notices aren't flowing through the marketplace really in any great numbers. Is the underwriting practice side of the industry and underwriting standards, is this something that you've seen to have improved? Do you think COVID could actually be a catalyst for further improvement there? Or are there areas of concern still? And let's stick with you, Bernard.
Sure. I think there's a lot of room for improvement in terms of end investors' understanding of the underwriting process, you know, how risk is originated, and on an annual basis, how contracts are renewed, and literally sort of the routine that underwriters use to with end brokers and how deals are made. Because I think it's very telling of then what issues you may or may not have, down the line. And I think that's really critical. I think technology is lacking generally in underwriting. At least that's the sense that I've sort of developed over a period of time. And while we put in, and the industry has put in a lot of effort in terms of risk modeling and the analytics, sometimes you feel that, whatever advantages have been gained might be wasted by, certain underwriting practices, which then kind of the advantage that you might gain from your modeling platform and all the effort you put into the risk modeling. So, as an end investor, that I try to better understand the underwriting process that our counterparties utilize. And sort of how rigorous they are in terms of reviewing contract wording, how sort of rigorous they are in terms of renewing the analysis every year, as opposed to taking the approach that, this is a contract we've renewed for a number of years. It hasn't changed. We'll do it, given the price is right. I think you really want to deal with a counterparty who is putting that effort every year and reviewing every contract as if it was a new relationship, if you will. Because I think the underwriting process at the end of the day is the beginning of the story. And as investors, we're sort of at the end of the pipe, and we need to understand that or make sure that the beginning of the underwriting process is of high quality, because that impacts the rest.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bernard. And I guess that's incredibly important at this time when the world is changing quite fast and values at risk are changing very quickly as well. Evelyn, from your point of view on the underwriting side, are there issues that you have noticed in the marketplace? Are there any concerns you've ever had? And how do you feel the COVID experience could change the delivery of underwriting standards across the market?
Well, it's a hot topic. I would say loose contract wording, recovering covered perils, is definitely on top of our list of concerns. And hopefully you're right that COVID-19 can indeed be a catalyst to improve on this. Because this time it's a pandemic, but next time it might be a terror event or even cyber in the future. And hopefully we did not get that far. I would say it's causing uncertainty on our end as it leads to negative surprises. And that's the whole thing with investors and boards of investors. No one likes the negative surprises. So our board signed up to onboard CAT risk. And I don't think that anyone in our organization imagined that COVID could lead to a substantial loss in our portfolio or to a loss at all even. So I would say from a trust perspective in the asset class, from investors, it would be very beneficial if going forward we could be more firm on these kinds of risks. And in addition, I also believe that also ILS managers and even reinsurance companies do not benefit from that. They also would like to keep constant their allocations. They don't like income streams that fluctuate a lot. So I think it's best for everyone to avoid as much as negative surprises as possible. And I do believe for at least a couple of years, as long as we remember these COVID, this COVID situation, I think it will be abandoned from contracts. But I'm not so sure whether whether we are a couple of years from now, whether we still remember that. So, to be seen.
Sure. Just as a quick aside, is there any... Sorry.
Yeah,
did someone want to jump in?
I wanted to quickly add something. Oh, yes, Bernard here. I quickly wanted to point out, too, that I think we shouldn't forget brokers, reinsurance brokers, in the discussion. It's not just end investors, fund managers, and reinsurers, but the broker role in the market. And I think sort of emphasizing these messages with the broker community is also extremely important.
Absolutely. They're obviously responsible for a great degree of the wordings that end up in the marketplace. I was just going to ask, as an aside, Evelyn, is there, obviously you're not keen to take pandemic exposure in a portfolio that's supposed to be natural catastrophe risk, but is there any basis on which you would look to assume pandemic exposure? Is parametric pandemic something that's potentially an ILS type product, do you believe, or is it an uninsurable systemic event?
Oh, I do believe that and also we already see that as part of the cat bonds, that pandemic can be a covered peril. It's not something that we invest in. But in general, if it's well-defined and has a clear mechanism when to pay out, I do believe it could be added to a portfolio of ILS. But then at least it's a risk that you take deliberately and you're being paid for that. When you're not aware that you've taken that kind of risk and it's still causing losses, then the risk was mispriced or underpriced. And that part I don't particularly like.
Of course. Thank you. So, Craig, actually, just a quick reminder for our audience that you can submit your questions through the Q&A box. We've got a few which we'll get to towards the end of the session. Just a reminder to get your questions in if you want to have something answered. So, Craig, let's move on to you. So you look at a much broader range of asset classes than just ILS alone. How at the Future Fund do you compare ILS to other opportunities? Is it purely on a return and correlation basis, or how also do you explain the benefits of this asset class to trustees and board? Because obviously it's not a simple one for people. And how do you have conversations about things like COVID and business interruption?
It's, you know, it's interesting, Steve, that you mentioned it being something that's not easy to explain. I actually went into this process thinking the same thing. And I in essence, got a stern reminder, if you will, in the beauty of making complex things simple by our chairman, when he essentially turned and said, look, you're selling insurance, right? Okay, how hard is that? You know, we tend, anybody in particular professions or lines of work tends to try to find ways to make things look complex, more complex than they actually are. And investment professionals are no different in that regard. That's what we're doing, right? What we have here essentially is a modestly sized reinsurance business. That's all it is. You know, we sell insurance policies. And the hurdle to clear with a board or with an investment committee is often, I think, surmounted by starting from that basic premise and being able to articulate what is a fairly straightforward rational thesis as to why insurance exists. If there was not a risk premium attached to the underwriting of insurance over a medium to long term, then the business itself wouldn't exist. People wouldn't bear that risk. And so it's got a very inherently appealing concept to somebody looking and saying, okay, well, this is distinct from an, you know, from an equity, if you will. And you can get into a discussion about, you know, equity being simply a wrapper for certain elements of insurance risk, and that's absolutely true. But I think that in that respect, it's actually it can take some time to get to that point where that light bulb goes off. But the ones that are there are certainly plenty of folks out there who are more skilled than me, and often they're in politics, that are able to sort of take that and sort of figure out, you know, you keep finding different places to stick the light bulb until it finally lights up, and until the IC or the board says, yep, okay, we get that, let's go. Once you get that ball rolling, there is that question of just how much risk one is willing to take on behalf of a diversified portfolio. And in that regard, for a group like us, it's going to look like any of the three of us. I think it's going to be, again, kind of the inverse of what an insurer would do. An insurer is, generally speaking, not going to have an investment-heavy portfolio, because that isn't the core of what, in theory, they're good at. It itself is a diversifying risk, right? Running a perhaps a longer duration bond portfolio may be a diversified risk for an insurer that has the bulk of their risk on foot on the insurance side of the balance sheet. So for us, the analysis is twofold. One is, if it doesn't make money, if we don't think it's going to make money over the long span of time, it probably isn't too handy, even if it diversifies, because that's not terribly compelling for a variety of reasons. But what is interesting for us is thinking about how much risk we want to run per dollar. That's where capital efficiency comes into play, and Evelyn alluded to that a little bit earlier. And so thinking about how to build a structure to best fit our capital needs and our ability to essentially have a fairly robust amount of risk per dollar, because we know it's going to diversify the overall portfolio. The other part is how much tail risk are we willing to bear on a single event or a single particularly bad year in this portfolio? That part actually tends to be more almost sort of psychological, I would say, as distinct from being a pure economic assessment. That if we were to sit there and say, okay, how much, if we look at our portfolio right now and go, okay, if we had one really, really bad hurricane, or a combination of a hurricane here, a typhoon there, and an earthquake there, what's the impact to NAV that we're going to suffer as a result of that? Of the future fund's NAV, that's a useful dialogue to have, if only for the simple reason that it would be seen as essentially a surprise loss from something that isn't sort of a core, you know, equity slash credit slash property type portfolio. So we've got to be wary about that particular risk and the potential there to have something outsized happen. But if market conditions are sufficiently compelling, and the pricing is particularly and uniquely compelling relative to other asset classes, that's when it's time to actually get the motor running and say, look, we're willing to tolerate, 2x basis points of potential lost, hit to NAV instead of 1x, because the upside of a relatively quiet year is so much more appealing, especially when we look at other options.
Great. Thank you, Craig. So, Evelyn, I thought it'd be interesting to ask you about you allocate capital and quite a few different points along the market chain through your range of partnerships and managers. Obviously, these different access points provide you with perhaps preferential access to risk, guaranteed access to risk. They can also help you to lower cost as well. But when we think about the market chain, there's also intermediation to consider as well. And I was wondering if you could talk us through a little bit about how you think about sort of efficiency for your capital when you put it to work.
Yeah, definitely the case. So I think I already alluded to the benefits of working together with large reinsurance companies. So it's the access of risk, large underwriting teams, modeling capabilities. So basically you can lever their full organization. And that also comes with a reserving specialist and claims handling, which turned out to be very handy in the last couple of years. I would say diversification is also in a way true, although diversification, at least in is always, I would say, a little bit limited in if you only do catastrophe reinsurance. But there is, of course, difference between our partners, and they have different preferences for regions that they allocate to. So we onboard a little bit of that diversification through allocating to our different partners. And we do see value in that. I would say also operational leverage is an important element. You can have an operational leverage as part of a commercial company, but it's, I would say, you can have more and I would say a more fair of a price with a reinsurance company than you can get elsewhere in the market. I also enjoy the fact that from day one, you can be fully ramped up, which is typically different from an ILS manager who needs to onboard to risk on a renewal by renewal basis. So it's a little bit faster to get your money working. And when it comes to costs, I don't per se see the difference in how we view costs from our reinsurance partners than we do from our ILS managers. It's kind of irrespective of the partner, how we look at costs. We take a look at the structure, and each time we judge whether the costs are fair in itself for that relevant structure. And if we believe that's the case, then we're willing to pay for that. And if not, we look for an alternative.
Okay, great. Thank you. And do you think on the frictional cost side, do you think there's more work for the industry as a whole to do, thinking about where frictional costs can be removed from the chain?
Yeah, I think that's definitely something I wish for. But also figured out that it's not very easy to accomplish. So we encourage always our partners to take out frictional costs wherever they can.
Thank you, Evelyn. Bernard, what's your view on sort of frictional cost and intermediation, sort of loading along the chain before the risk gets to you?
I'd like to minimize it, if at all possible. I have to apologize. I've dropped off from the conversation for a few minutes there, so I didn't catch the whole commentary. But I think, obviously, you always want to understand the costs in as much as possible and understand the motivation for a transaction or the deal that's being shown to you, you know, whether it is a transaction that is essentially a fee generation mechanism for the counterparty, or if there's a real need for that transaction and for it being shown to you. So again, it's a question of really digging into the transaction, into the motivation, understanding what the costs are, how they compare to the industry, and whether they're always warranted. And, you know, I think there's always an element of, well, this is the way it's been done before, so this is what we're going to do this year. And you always want to revisit that and challenge it and make sure that you get the benefit of whatever cost you're effectively taking on.
Great. Thank you, Bernard. So we've got a few questions in from the audience, so I thought we'd just pick some of those off, and I will direct them probably just to one person at a time for each question so we can get through a few. So this one I'm going to send to you, Craig. Do you have an appetite for life ILS risks and I guess also other areas of exposure, perhaps specialty lines, or are you strictly cat focused?
At this point, the focus is property cat. We have, I think we've toyed with the idea of doing some things in life, not in life settlements. That's a no-go for us. But areas where if for some reason there's actually an underwriting benefit, if you will, be picked up, on the life side, that in turn makes it a little bit hard. I think the idea of life insurance slash annuity, an annuity business, as being a levered play on credit is not terribly appealing for us. We've got plenty of levered plays on credit elsewhere in my portfolio. I don't need a life wrapper around that. But I think we continue to look at those perils. The core question for me with a lot of the PNC perils away from property cat is what the actual need is for ILS capacity. What makes property cat a logical candidate for ILS capacity is the fact that it is high volatility, that it is high risk. So if you've got a balance sheet that can easily accommodate certain kinds of PNC business, there probably isn't much reason to go off and get an ILS partner to come in and provide capital for that, unless there's probably my gut tells me that there's a degree of misalignment there that we'd have to get our heads around and get comfortable with on that level, the same way we have to get around or get comfortable with the level of misalignment that comes into play in property cat. So the mind is open, but the wallet thus far has been closed.
Yeah, no, it seems that way with a lot of investors, that you're looking for opportunities where there's a clear need for your capacity rather than just an opportunistic need to build what could only be a very small portfolio potentially as well. And obviously you need meaningful scale in these lines of business as well. Another question, which maybe we'll direct to, which is actually on a similar line, but more on emerging risks and less well-modeled cat risks. How do you think about those in terms of return on risk and what your appetite is for them when you're looking at opportunities or modeling them, or your managers are looking at those? And I'll direct that to Evelyn.
Okay, thank you. I don't think that we are front runners in these kinds of risk. We try to stick to areas where there are indeed where risks are well modeled, understand where there's clear building codes. So I would say these emerging risks, we're open to that, but there need to come some changes that need to come with better models. And also they need to be well priced, because for now we see that the diversifying risks are trading, I would say, at a discount relative to peak risk, and I think we still need a fair compensation for adding these risks to our portfolio.
Great, thank you, Evelyn. So one for you, Bernard. It's on the topic of standardization around valuation methods, collateral release mechanisms, and I suppose we can include things like buffer loss tables, etc. here. Would more standardization help the ILS market? And are there industry initiatives, or would you like to see industry initiatives that could catalyze that?
In general, standardization is a good thing. Right, you want to find the most efficient mechanism, and have as many people use it. I'm not sure that I can point to one specific area, but I'll go back to the area that's at the top of my mind, which is sort of the post-event loss estimation process and the whole chain of communication between the ultimate cedent and at one end and at the other end, the investor, and how loss estimates are being communicated across that chain, and how frequently. I think I don't know of there being any standardization there, and I think that's one of the issues that we've observed in 2017-2018, in that it leaves every ILS manager or counterparty to really sort of improvise and do as best as they can to come up with numbers and determine how often they need to update their investors. And it's in general a messy process, and I wish there was a better way of dealing with that. And I would look to technology here to help with that process, because the process of having to rely on your broker, who then needs to sort of chase the cedants to get some tidbit of information and relaying that information along to the portfolio manager, who then has to decide how, you know, the level of quality of credibility of that data point and what to do with it is, you know, right now it's really, as I said, a messy process. And I think there must be a way of standardizing that. And again, I would point you to the brokers to perhaps, you know, take the lead here, because at the end of the day, they are involved in, you know, obviously origination, but then post-event loss notification, and they're sort of always involved in the process. And so I think they could take the lead in proposing some form of standardization or technological solution to the issue.
Great. Thank you, Bernard. Yeah, that does seem like an area that's ripe for improvement and perhaps disruption by technology, given it's really just information flow that could be facilitated much more smoothly right. And transparently.
But having said that, sorry, Steve, I should probably quickly finish that off by saying I don't think technologies and standardization are the end all and be all. I think at the end of the day, I would also propose that investors still need to understand the challenges that underwriters face and brokers face in the traditional market in dealing with very scarce and very sort of low confidence information after an event, and understand the fact that there is going to, you can't get away from there being a waiting period during which losses develop and information crystallizes. So I think it's, you know, you have to sort of maintain the right level of expectation as to what standardization and technology can achieve.
Sure. No, that's a good point. Have to remain rational about what's actually possible in a industry like this. Craig, a question about scale of the investment opportunity and whether any of you are finding it harder to get increased allocations to portfolios at this time, and whether the ability to scale up the opportunity is seen as an issue perhaps at your institutions?
At this point, I think the you know, like I said, our sizing is on the order of 1%. That's sort of the unit of measurement to think about here. It's not 2, 3, or 5. And so 1% of $160 billion Australian portfolio, you can do the math on that to get a ballpark range of where we are. There's plenty, I think, of room for us to grow the portfolio, and our managers, I think, have certainly been capable of placing that with I think with a high degree of quality attached to that. Evelyn's probably going to give a better answer for you, because I think she's got a few more euros in the game than we do. But I think so far so good.
Great. Thanks, Craig. Evelyn, do you want to add to that?
Yeah. So we are currently at 2.5% of pension plan assets. So we're close to 6 billion euro invested in CAT. It's still not an issue, even today, to increase that. So we added quite some capital during the June renewals and July renewals this year. And I can see... I can definitely see us growing by another percent if we need to. I'm not saying that we will. I'm just saying that the market is there. From an internal perspective, I think it's every year our strategy team looks at the kind of default strategic allocation that they would like to allocate to all asset classes. And I can imagine that there is a cap on ILS maybe hit earlier than some other categories because of the very severity and the left tail distribution. So it's I don't expect this category to be over 6% or close to 5.
Sure. Thank you, Evelyn. So I think we'll take one last question from the audience, and I'll direct this to Bernard. Has your perception of relative value between cat bonds and other sort of collateralized reinsurance opportunities changed at all in recent months, given the various issues around definitions of perils and coverage and also trapped collateral?
not really, to be honest with you. I don't really distinguish, but a lot of this, a lot of difference between, you know, cat bonds and other forms of ILS risk transfer. You know, I think one of the issues you have to be mindful with cat bonds is that, you know, these are products that have been packaged for you, the investor, and so if you don't pay attention, that packaging can obfuscate some of the same issues that you would find in other forms of risk transfer. So, and I think that's something to be aware of. And you always really want to treat it as any other risk transfer transaction. But in terms of value, I mean, as we all know, the cat bond market has fared very well, relatively speaking. And, you know, I'll leave it at that. It's a more limited market. I think there's definitely, you know, perhaps more effort to limit risk or exposure through a cat bond product. But at the end of the day, given the prevalence of indemnity type cat bonds, you're always going to be faced with sort of secondary loss sort of sources that are there, but, you know, are perhaps not obvious. And, you know, such as BI, and you really have to pay attention to that.
Great. Thank you, Bernard. We've run over a bit in terms of time, but I'll just ask you all for one final sort of closing statement. What's the one thing you would like to see from ILS fund managers, reinsurers, the people who are courting you? To what would you like to see them doing going forwards that would encourage you to look more seriously at working with people in the space? Is there one thing you can identify? Let's begin with Craig.
Only one. I think we've probably been through a lot of different areas here. I think what all three of us are looking for, right, is a degree of, you know, is we're looking for transparency, we're looking for humility, we're looking for a proactive relationship. We know that this is an industry where almost all of the surprises are bad ones. So the best way to maintain a high quality relationship is to mitigate the extent to which those surprises come to us, and do it in a way that we understand and we know the risks we're taking. And so when the losses come, they're ones that we are willing to accept and acknowledge as part of the investment process.
Great. Thank you, Craig. Thanks for being involved in this discussion. Evelyn, any final words?
No, I totally agree with Craig, so keep it there.
Sure. And Bernard?
Well, I have to plug in climate change. Evelyn brought it up, but I think that's an increasingly important topic. And being at a fund that has only just started working the ILS market, I know that there have been a lot of questions from the board and other stakeholders in terms of, you know, do we understand the impact of climate change? And I think that's increasingly important. And I think it warrants more than just a single slide at the end of a pitch book that, you know, very sort of brushes very broadly over the topic. And I think all parties in this market are going to have to perhaps beef up, you know, their own understanding of you know, climate science, climate risks, and really pay attention to that, and also put pressure on the catastrophe risk modeling firms and vendors to make the necessary sort of adjustments to their models if they are warranted. But again, it's a question of education, I think, all around.
Wonderful. Thank you, Bernard. Thank you. So thank you very much to Evelyn, Bernard, and Craig, I really appreciate you all sparing me some time today in your respective time zones. And I hope our audience found that an interesting discussion. We certainly touched on a very wide range of topics there, and clearly there's a lot that managers in the space are doing very well, and there's a lot of things that the industry as a whole could do better that would make the ILS investment opportunity more attractive and also easier, I guess, for people as well. So thank you again. Thank you to our audience. Coming up in literally about 45 minutes, we have a keynote speech from Morten Lane of Lane Financial, which is live as well. So hopefully some of you will get to log back in for that. But with that, I'll just thank our panelists again and talk to you all later on.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.